Hey guys, it's Andrew Knowlton subbing in for Adam to introduce today's podcast. Yesterday, we revealed our top 10 best new restaurants in America of 2017. Every year, senior editor Julia Kramer and I spend months, a lot of time on the road, crisscrossing the country, eating at all the restaurants we think might be worthy of a spot on the list. We choose 50 nominees, and then we narrow that down to what we call the Hot 10. You can read about it in our September issue and online at bonappetit.com. And today, Julia and I will be talking to Adam about how we created the list, what went into it, our best meals, the best dishes we had. All right, here we go.
Kramer, welcome back to Bon Appetit, kinda, sorta.
Thanks for having me on.
How's the baby?
He's doing good. Loves to eat and sleep.
Ah, kinda like us.
How old is Philip now?
He is 15 days old.
15 days.
Wow, so you've been at home for 15 straight days, which was the opposite of your sort of routine while researching the Hot 10 when you were on the road all the time, right?
Yeah, and I thought that was really hard work. And I would say that the first 15 days of the baby have been much harder.
Really?
Wait a minute. You mean having a baby is harder than our job? Work, going to restaurants?
Yep.
I do. When Marlon was born, God, 9 years ago, the one thing I remember, he was born in December. The entire month of December felt like one long, dark day. There was no beginning, middle, or end. It just kept going.
Well, it was dark. It was
December. It was dark, but you're always like getting up in the middle of the night, and it just the hours. There was, you know what I mean?
I remember for the second one, I don't remember anything because I went to China a week after my child.
Yes, Knowlton got on a plane with Danny Bowen to do an article on him when Mission Chinese was happening, opening in New York and stuff. And they literally, a week after Sig was born, went to China and left his wife at home.
I just want to say that. Whatever it says about me, but it says a lot about my wife and what a lovely person
yes,
she is.
God bless Christina, and also says you're committed to your job. So let's talk about that. All right, so this year, guys, again, researching the Hot 10, picking the 10 best new restaurants in America while also assembling a list of the 50 nominees or finalists required a lot of travel, a lot of eating. Kramer, let's start with you. We have to bring this up again. A year ago when you were researching your list, you literally ate yourself into the hospital thinking you could go 2 weeks straight on the road, going to 5 restaurants a day. You got pneumonia. You went back to your parents' house, got in your bedroom, and like just collapsed and ended up in the emergency room, correct?
Wow, it sounds so depressing when you tell it like that. But yeah, it's true.
It's true. So how did you change things up this year? Did you was there a different strategy in terms of going out and eating so much?
She got pregnant. That's what she did this year.
Yeah, so most of the travel this year took place in my second trimester. And so my goal was really not to get sick again because that would have really been bad. To be honest, I think I just learned my lesson a little bit, and it helped this year that I wasn't drinking. So I think that helped keep things in moderation a little bit. But I still ate just the same as I did the previous year and bounced from city to city the same way, and was very grateful every day that I still felt good. So
did you
work out?
Compared to last year, Julia, did you have more of an appetite, or were there some times where you were looking at a plate of oysters and were just like, I can't eat this because I feel sick at my stomach?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to get upset comments from listeners, but I did eat a tremendous amount of raw seafood on this trip. My doctor said it was fine. And I had pretty much the same appetite. People would say to me, oh, this is like the perfect job for you because you're eating for two. And I was like, well, like I kind of was already eating for two, so I don't need to be like eating for four. So I would say it was about, I kind of kept up the appetite. And the only hard part was it's just a long time to be sitting at an uncomfortable stool or chair or something when you're pregnant, because you're not talking about like one meal that's 2 hours. You're talking about maybe two or three meals, and so I often got stuck in sort of uncomfortable situations physically, but that was harder for me than I had no problem eating all the food.
I mean, that's an interesting point. These days, in the last 10 years, there's been that advent of, I don't know, I guess you would call it the Momofuku effect of a lot of restaurants that now have benches or stools or very hard wooden seats. And it's a different sitting experience. I went to this restaurant in D.C. for a talk, and I'm blanking on the name. I feel bad. But it was a bit more catered to a more sort of like Washington lobbyist sort of clientele. And they had these big, cushy leather chairs. And I sat down. I was like, wow, this is so relaxing and pleasant. I forgot what it's like to come to a restaurant and be really comfortable. And I was like, oh, this is nice. So, yeah, I enjoyed that. Kramer, so just for those who didn't listen last year, so you stuck to a lot of the more Eastern Seaboard, so you didn't have to do long flights out west, correct?
I did. I did the East Coast and the Midwest this year, and Andrew took the West Coast and the South.
All right, so let's say you're in Chicago or Philly or something. Can you describe your average day? I mean, how many restaurants are you going to? Are you still doing yoga? Give us a rundown.
Sure. So I guess we could take, for instance, a day in Boston. So I take the train in the morning from New York and then go immediately to probably two places for lunch. So one of the places that I went to when I was in Boston for a couple of days, one of the lunches that I had was at a deli called Mamala's, which ended up on the top 50 list. That was definitely my favorite meal that I had in Boston and Cambridge. And so I would have this delicious meal at Mamala's. I would eat, all this chopped liver and bagels and pastrami and all this stuff. Mm. And then I would head to the next spot and eat, lamb sandwich or a tortilla española or whatever it might be. And then in the afternoon last year, I would definitely have done hot yoga. I did hot yoga every day on the road last year, which is awesome. This year I couldn't do that. So I mostly would just try to take a long walk or a nap or maybe do a little bit of shopping. Just something where I was not eating for, 2 hours. And then I would rally and head out to, two dinners, maybe stop by a bar where I wasn't going to drink, but I wanted to just have some snacks or check out a certain trend that we were interested in or something like that. So, the usual schedule,
And then when you're going to dinner, for instance, are you calling up old friends from college who you haven't seen in 12 years, but you heard live in Boston now? And like, hey, I know we haven't talked since that one time on Facebook, but do you want to go have dinner with me? Or what are you doing for dining companions?
I'm buying.
Yeah. That's actually my favorite part of the whole thing is I get to see all these people who I would never plan a visit to go hang out with. But because I'm in their city and whether it's, Denver or Cincinnati or wherever it might be, I'm always meeting up with random people. And if I don't know someone in that city, I'll ask around to friends, be like, hey, do you know anyone in Kansas City who would like to go out for dinner? And you can always find someone.
Knowlton, how does Julia's schedule jibe with yours when you're on the road this past year?
What I wanted to do this year is be much more strategic. I felt like over the past couple years that I, towards the end of the research, kind of fell off a cliff and just got this kind of food nausea. Mm-hmm. It was just too much. And at the end of the day, I was going to places. You still want to check out as many as you can, but I just became more strategic about it and would just pop in and not feel guilty. Like if somebody, if I talked to somebody and they said, you don't need to go there, somebody I trusted, then I didn't go there. I just didn't have the time to do it.
How often have you guys walked into a place and when you're on a blind date and you see the person, you're just like, yeah, this is not going to work. How often have you walked to a restaurant and like, yeah, I'm not going to do this.
I mean, for me, I would say every single day.
Really?
I would walk in because, I would try to hit, whether it's, I wouldn't have 10 meals, but I'm constantly in between walking around and peering into windows. And if you've been doing this for a while, you can kind of just you know, it's not a bad thing, but you have your types. I have my type. Mm-hmm. I really do. And that doesn't mean I can't be surprised sometimes to be like, wow.
Are we talking about blind dates or restaurants?
Well, we're talking about relationships, whether they're with people or with restaurants.
Nice metaphor.
And I can look in and be like, I look at the menu and be like, I don't need the warm goat cheese arugula salad. Like, it's just not what I'm looking for. And I don't think it represents what's going on in food in America. So I would be like, you know what? Cross it off the list.
Well, also, you also bring up a point, and the two of you, which we, in the September issue of Bon Appetit, which is our best new restaurants issue, the entire front of the magazine is devoted to, quote unquote, everything but the food. And that restaurants, so much of the restaurant experience is beyond food. It's the lighting, it's the playlist, it's the graphics, it's the furniture, it's the cool bathrooms. Mm-hmm. And that's at least half of one's experience when at a restaurant is more than just food, right?
I think the best restaurants, you know, they take the lighting and they take the waiters' uniforms and they take the design all into account, because for the average person who doesn't necessarily know how to make food or doesn't know all the crazy ingredients, that's how they can relate to a restaurant. And I think a mediocre meal can only be enhanced by the setting and the hospitality, and a really good meal even the food can be hurt by the lack of that.
Yeah.
And so I don't understand restaurants. I mean, I know, understand shoestring budgets, but there's a way to do it that still has a personality.
And
too many restaurants, though, when you go into them, it's just they have zero personality. You don't know what city you're in, or there's no point of view.
Yeah. I think in you on this year's list, which we'll get to shortly, you salute a lot of smaller, independent-minded restaurants that still have a lot of spirit and attitude and personality, and that there is not a direct connection between how much money you spend building out a restaurant and the effect of it.
It's like
fashion. You can spend a lot of money on bad clothes and look like a jackass.
Yes.
Or you can spend very little money and have just great natural personal style. So let's talk about a few of the trends that you guys picked up on and enjoyed this year as you were eating around, some things that sort of popped up at restaurant after restaurant that you really sort of liked, whether it's food-wise or sort of style decor-wise. Kramer, you got one? Want to start with one?
Yeah. Where do we want to start? Well, the absolute biggest trend, which was what I wrote a piece about in the June issue, was wood-fired grilling. That was just like insane to me as I was traveling the country this year, how many restaurants were doing live fire cooking in really unexpected places, whether it was Vicia in St. Louis, which is on our top 50 list, or the Purple House in Yarmouth, Maine, which is a wood-fired bagel place, which is also on the top 50 list. It felt like half the places I walked into had these like raging fires going, which was really awesome. On a similar beat, Andrew chose a few barbecue places for this list. I think more than we typically have, would you say?
Yeah, there's a lot of movement in the barbecue world this year and opening, places moving into cities and, you know, kind of that stereotype that a barbecue place has to be down a country road and kind of be in a shack and all that. Like, why does that have to be that? And a lot of them opened up like big, beautiful restaurants that happen to serve barbecue.
Barbecue is big business these days, and it's fascinating even, and you know, we've seen this sort of, I don't even call it a renaissance in New York, because it's not like it goes back to having great barbecue back in the day, but there's been this surge of really good quality barbecue in cities like New York that normally never had it, and it's spreading, and it's like good, legit barbecue. And you, Andrew, you're a Southern guy. You'd testify to that, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's no other food that can bring people together from all different walks of life than barbecue, period. Yeah. I mean, there's nothing like it.
What about, Nolton, what about you in terms of either food or vibe?
To me, this was the year of the sandwich, and I know that people might be like, sandwiches have been around forever, but this was really the year that I kind of, for the past couple of years, just got sick of sandwiches, because I just, you know, there was no inventiveness going on. And I think the shift from the tweezer kind of 10 people standing over a plate and doing that kind of sent people back to the drawing board, and what do they really like to eat? And for a lot of people, that was sandwiches, and especially chefs.
Sandwiches and barbecue.
So I think you were getting these crazily inventive, and we can talk about that later, because that's a kind of a drum roll moment, but you know, from Mean Sandwich in Seattle to Lucky's Deli in Durham, North Carolina, to a certain place in New Orleans, to even non-sandwich restaurants, it was just like, you know, taking seemingly classic and like things you couldn't change, like a bologna sandwich, and making it new again. And I just thought it was so exciting, trying all this stuff. And it's hard to cook food that people have some sort of reference to and nostalgia, because there's a lot of expectation when you do that. And to me, that was the most exciting thing, is walking into a sandwich place at 2 in the afternoon and seeing somebody bring that same focus and detail to attention that they would, you know, a tasting menu yeah. 5 years ago.
Oh, very cool. I have a lot of opinions when it comes to sandwiches. and I love the fact that when people give sandwiches the love they deserve and they really think out the yeah. architecture of the sandwich, the mixture of ingredients, where do you put the meat in relation to the vegetables so they don't slide apart, having the right amount of meat so it doesn't overflow. Like, it's an art, and God bless them. Kramer, what decor or sort of vibe trends did you enjoy this year while dining out?
You know, they say having a baby drains all the brains out.
You did something fun in the magazine about paint colors and like the color palettes of restaurants, which I find fascinating.
Yeah. Thank you for reminding me. Sorry. One thing that I thought was really fun this year was that there seemed to be a little more color and fun in the design of restaurants. I feel like for the last couple of years, there was a lot of white Subway tile, a lot of that like Kinfolk magazine, very spare, minimalist, feels like you're in Silver Lake type of vibe, which is very beautiful and kind of soothing, but can also feel a little bit, I don't know, all the places start to feel a little bit the same. And so it was cool to go to, say, Dixta in St. Louis and have the walls be painted, in sort of like teal and deep blue and pink. And obviously, I think a lot of people know that this is a big year for pink. There was a ton of pink in restaurants. So that was sort of fun and lively and just a little bit, brought a little bit more joie de vivre, I think, to the whole experience.
I thought from doing this for several years, this was the most fun I had eating out this year. I don't know if that's a reaction to, you know, the times or what, but if I start looking at the 50 and then I look at the 10, they're all fun restaurants. You know, there's nothing that's too serious or taking itself too seriously. It was like, I don't know if you had that same thing, Julia, but I feel like we had a good time this year, and it was exciting.
We're going to do our hot 10 drum roll in a minute. But before we get to that, one feature we've had the last couple of years, which I've really enjoyed as a reader slash editor, is Restaurant City of the Year. Last year, it was Washington, D.C.
That's correct.
My hometown, which shocked me. I was like, really? And then I was like, oh. And then I went down there recently, and I was like, oh, wow. There are so many restaurants in D.C. now that I want to go to. And how sort of vibrant that city has become and diverse. And I just thought I was really inspired how restaurants can sort of inject a town with sort of life and point of view and personality. So I thought that was great. That was last year. Julia, what is this year's City of the Year?
I'm very excited to say that this year's restaurant city is Chicago.
Who's from Chicago? You're from Chicago. Did we vet this, Nolton? Did you sign off on this?
All I know is I saw pictures of the baby's room, and there's Cub stuff all over the walls. So I think somebody got a kickback from the tourism board of Chicago.
I'm sure some aldermen were extending Julia's some stuffed envelopes.
I just want to say that Andrew was completely on board with this and agrees with me that Chicago is the restaurant city of the year.
It's true. I'm just glad that I don't have to hear you talk about the merits of a Chicago hot dog anymore, because you realize there's more to Chicago than just deep dish pizza.
What did you love about Chicago this year, dining-wise and restaurant-wise?
Okay, so I'll just say, you know, even though I am from Chicago, I really do not think I'm biased toward it. Last year, we didn't even have any Chicago restaurants on the Hot 10. But this year, you know, obviously I made a few visits to Chicago, as did Andrew, and I was just blown away. It was like each time I went home, there was not enough hours in the day to go to all the new restaurants that had opened and all the places that I heard were really great. So some of the highlights were a new Mexican restaurant called Mi Tocaya, which is from this woman chef named Diana Sevilla. I'm not exactly sure I'm pronouncing her name right. And she just sort of popped onto the scene a couple years ago, and I was just blown away by her food. It's a small little place in Logan Square, which is still sort of the most happening restaurant neighborhood in Chicago. And I really loved that place, and that was sort of on the more casual end of things, although it is sit down. And then there were the higher end places that opened, like Smith, which is from these chefs, John and Karen Shields, who used to have a restaurant called Townhouse in Virginia and came back to Chicago and opened this sort of fine dining tasting menu restaurant with a more casual bar with this amazing burger downstairs. And that's in the West Loop. And then it was just like, I couldn't get enough meals in at every end of the spectrum, whether it was, you know, just like a casual lunch place that served sausages like Kimski in Bridgeport, or like a beautiful tasting menu at Elski, which is also in the West Loop. It's just, I don't know. I was really blown away. I couldn't get over it.
Andrew, would you say, is there a common trait that unites restaurants in Chicago, like there might be in terms of like Portland restaurants or certain cities, or, you know, Austin or something, you know?
I don't know. When I think about Chicago over the past years, and particularly to the Hot 10, it seems like Chicago is a incubator for kind of international restaurants where you had Fat Rice a few years ago, you had Ruxpin a few years ago, you had Parachute. And I think these are all first or second generation immigrants who are taking the cuisine they grew up with, but, you know, flipping it on its head and making it modern in a way. And I think for whatever reason, Chicago, you know, encourages that. And, you know, I don't know why that is, you know, because sometimes people think of it as such a meat and potatoes town, but it's so diverse in terms of the food there. And it, you know, it's I don't know. I find over the past couple of years, it's become one of the most exciting cities. You know, even it's just not pretentious. It doesn't take itself too seriously
It doesn't. I think the food there is very fun and accessible, but you still have those sort of those pillars of the city in terms of like Grant Achatz and his influence on the city. Mm-hmm. You have
Rick Bayless,
and you also have Paul Kahn with you know, with Blackbird and Avec and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And those, so there's sort of a standard of excellence that those chefs have sort of established for the rest of the city to sort of aspire to.
And a lot of those, I mean, that's an important point that, you know, a lot of those great chefs are, you know, they are mentors, and those people go and stay in Chicago and open up their other restaurants.
Yeah, someone tweeted out the other day when we announced our 50, how many of the chefs nominated in the 50 were Achatz disciples. Did you see that tweet?
I didn't.
Yeah, I forget. There's someone. I can find it on our tweet on the Twitter. All right, Kramer, are you ready to announce the Hot 10, the best new restaurants in America?
I'm so ready.
Drum roll. Okay, so here's what we're going to do. We're going to bang through the Hot 10, 10 through 1. Each restaurant, whichever of you guys ended up writing up that restaurant and sort of taking it on as your own, you're going to talk about it, what you loved about it, and then talk about what the most delicious thing you ate at that restaurant was, okay? So.
Ooh, sounds great.
Before I do that, I just want to say this Hot 10 was compiled 152 days. Julie and I spent on the road, 35,000 miles traveled. We went to 41 cities. I personally ate 72 oysters with this research in mind. 12 cutlets. We stole 134 menus also from all the restaurants.
Cutlets, that was one of my favorite trends of the year. We have something in the September issue, like the cutlet country, from schnitzel to katsu to milanese, like crispy fried breaded meat. Never not good.
And zero In-N-Out burgers consumed this year for me. Anyway. All right. So number 10
yes.
on our list is a restaurant in Raleigh, North Carolina called Brewery Bavana. It's an interesting restaurant. It's on paper, it sounds like a mess. It's basically four concepts in one. There's a floral shop. There's a brewery with a long beer, kind of beer bar. There's a little kind of bookstore that also has like a library that you can go check stuff out of. And then if that wasn't enough, they serve dim sum. And it's this beautiful, it's right along a park. It's this beautiful space. It's white. There's flowers everywhere. There's palms. And it almost was like a community center for Raleigh.
Ooh, I like that.
And a place where... And they make a point of this, is everyone is welcome. North Carolina has been in the press recently mm-hmm. for some stuff. The interesting thing about this is a sister and brother duo, Van Visa and Vansana Nolintha, who are first generation. They're Laotian. They have a restaurant next door, which is a Laotian restaurant. But they met this guy, Patrick Woodson, who wanted to open up a brewery. And they became friends. He had traveled in Laos. And... next thing you know, they're teaming up. He's opening the brewery. They're opening the restaurant inside. And it's just, it could be, it's an amazing restaurant to exist in Raleigh because it's, I don't know, it's so ambitious in a way. It feels like a concept, but it was just, they combined four of their loves and four of the people who run each of the units in there. And on top of that, you're getting dim sum that is as good as any that I had this year.
All right. Best, most delicious thing you ate or drank there.
I would say the crab fried rice, and it arrives covered in this huge egg crepe. It almost looks like a dome, and then you just kind of, cut it up and mix it all around. And we're so close to the coast there, so the crab is just so fresh. That's an amazing dish.
That's amazing. All right, number 9. Is this you, Julia?
This is me. Number 9 is Nixta, which is a Mexican restaurant in St. Louis. I was really excited to try and get to some of the smaller cities in the Midwest this year. That was definitely a goal of mine. And it really paid off because I had amazing meals in both Kansas City and St. Louis. And Nixta is run by a chef named Teo Carrion, and he worked for a long time at a restaurant called Alea, which is owned by a guy named Ben Paremba, who also owns Nixta. And as I mentioned, it's a very colorful, fun restaurant. And what I think sets the cooking apart from other Mexican restaurants is that the chef really pulls from so many different sources. Like, it's very much his style of cooking, and that he incorporates, Mediterranean flavors. There's like rose water in the ceviche, but he also is making his grandmother's mole. And it's just the most delicious food, and you just want to go there and drink a ton of mezcal and hang out. And I would say the best thing that I ate there was the octopus, and I had a ton of octopus this year. I don't know if you did too, Andrew. And this was just the most perfectly cooked, so crispy on the outside, tender on the inside without being like weirdly soft and mushy, and served with one of, I think, like two or three different moles that Carrion makes in-house. So it's a very fun place. I think everyone should go to St. Louis and go there.
All right. Number 8.
Number 8, that's me. That is... Kamuri Tatsuya, which is in Austin, Texas. The gentleman, Japanese guys who owned this place first opened up Ramen Tatsuya, which was in our top 50 2013. So this is something that Julie and I do, is kind of track these chefs as they open up other restaurants and see how they've grown. And this one is cool because it's a mashup basically between a izakaya, which is kind of like a Japanese gastropub, and Texas barbecue joint. And the minute you walk in, you see the Japanese writing and all the Japanese kind of kitsch on the walls, but then it smells like a Texas barbecue joint.
I would like to go here.
You would like this place. Yeah. It's loud. It's rambunctious. I kind of...
And they have ice cold Japanese beer?
ice cold. They have ice cold Lone Star too. They got it all. Adam, you'll know this reference, the Double Deuce Bar. Do you know what the Double Deuce Bar is?
This is from Roadhouse.
Roadhouse with Patrick Swayze. Yeah.
I was watching that on cable the other day where there was like the big fist fight.
Oh, yeah.
But then the guy walks in, the owner or whatever, and he's like, all right, that's enough.
When you're sitting at the booth and you're kind of like, you're eating like ramen filled with brisket, or you can eat these crazy stuff like shiokara, which is squid marinated in its own innards, which is delicious. You almost think that Patrick Swayze is going to kind of ramble through the door because it's this low-slung roadhouse. Everyone's having a good time. There's like fish bowls that you're drinking these, you know, libations out of. And I don't know, it was just so much fun. But also the food is so amazing, and it's this kind of cross-cultural thing that, I don't know, I just had a good time with it. I mean, I think if you go there, there's a whole section of the menu that's called chinmi, which basically translates to Japanese to rare taste. And they have a bunch of that stuff. That's where the squid is. They have crispy stingray fin. They have charred mateko, which is kind of salted cod roe. But then they also have all kinds of smoke stuff, and there's something there for everybody. It makes me jealous about Austin, Texas, thinking about Kamuri.
All right, well, I'm going next time, go to South by Southwest or something. Number seven, another restaurant named Spring.
Okay, so this restaurant is normcore to the T. I don't know if you can call a restaurant normcore, but again, it's called Spring. There's little to no ambiance. The vibe is quite welcoming. That's the other thing. It's not in Atlanta. It's kind of in a suburb of Atlanta. It's in Marietta, Georgia, which is a cool little, there's a little town center, and you cross the train tracks. It's a husband and wife, both Korean, first generation. It's run by Brian So and his wife Carrie, who runs the front of the house. And I would say, and Julie and I talked about this, is this was a tough one because what we were talking about earlier about how ambiance and lighting and all that plays, I kind of had to remove myself and just focus on the food here. I think I didn't have any other food during my travels that was so perfectly executed and a return to basics. Like, we're talking about a shrimp bisque that sounds kind of, you know, meh on paper, but then when you taste it, it's like, wow, this is, I remember falling in love with bisque for the first time, or a duck jus that just is reduced and the duck is cooked perfectly. And here's this guy who doesn't even come out of the kitchen. He's not looking for any kind of fame. This is what he could afford, him and his wife could afford, to open this place just outside of Atlanta. And I didn't have better food in terms of the technique and the cooking. It kind of blew me away. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to look past this other stuff that I, you know, didn't necessarily dig. And this is about the food. And my parents are from Atlanta, and I took them there twice, and they've probably been a dozen times. Well,
speaking of quick interlude here, in terms of execution, I was at The Grill the other night in the former Four Seasons space here in New York, run by the Carbone guys. And that restaurant opened up a little late for this list in terms of your guys' research, having already gotten it done in terms of getting the magazine out the door.
Perhaps next year.
Yeah, but they had one dish, it was like a duck breast, and came to the table, and it was just a sliced duck breast with kind of an orange jus, sort of, you know, a take on duck à l'orange, and that's it on a plate. And it was just, you're like, wow. Yeah. It was just so beautifully prepared, and the way they hang and dry the duck, and then prepare it, and just the perfect right temperature, and the glaze was like a little bit sweet but not too sweet, right. And that's really hard to do.
No, and it makes you realize that so much food that's served today has so much bells and whistles on it.
The fact that, like, is it really that good? To strip it down and do one thing really well is the hardest thing.
Absolutely.
All right, so number six, Giant in Chicago, the year's best dining city.
Yes, this is one of two Chicago restaurants on the list. This is a restaurant from Jason Vincent, who is a chef who I just kind of love. He cooked at Knightwood, which is sort of been around for a while, farm-to-table restaurant in Logan Square that is one of my favorite places to eat in Chicago. Then he was the chef of Knightwood, which sort of similar in Pilsen, and then took a little bit of a hiatus and then opened this place, Giant, in Logan Square. And it's just the perfect neighborhood restaurant, and Jason just has a real warmth, and he seems to just have a lot of fun cooking, and everyone in the kitchen seems to share in that. And I think the food really reflects that. It's just all the food that you want to eat. There's, you know, the best onion rings that you've ever had. There's, sort of his chef version of tater tots. There's of waffle fries. I mean, there's just this sort of kind of almost funny, goofy approach to the food. But then at the same time, they're making, you know, five beautiful pastas in-house. And they're really doing like sort of beautiful execution on the food while still having it just be very like craveable, delicious dishes.
Yeah,
it's the kind of restaurant that if I lived in Chicago, I would be there at least once a week.
Yeah, I went there when I was in town last September. It's a fun restaurant. Some people might call it sort of deluxe stoner food, but there's something mischievous to a lot of the dishes. Really delicious, as you said, really well executed. Those waffle fries you mentioned they're actually piped out, like. Correct?
Yeah, they're aerated, like in a CO2, and then aerated, and he puts them on a waffle grill and then, does them.
Yeah, and so they're very, very inventive waffle fries. And also, his food, he likes spice. So many of his dishes had a high degree of chili, even the dessert when we were there.
Well, even the pastas, which pastas aren't, I mean, you get a little bit of heat in some pastas, but, this stuff was, it burns.
All right, best thing you ate there, Julia.
Well, so the best thing I ate there was on my first visit, which was, I think, at the tail end of August or early September, and I had this amazing corn salad, which, similar to what you were just saying, it's very just fun and delicious to eat. And then when we called in the recipe from him is when I realized, oh my God, this thing has, 20 different components. That's, I think, what makes his food so interesting is you don't realize the layers of flavor and texture that are in every single dish.
Yeah, I think we would all appreciate what we're eating at restaurants so much more if we actually knew all the steps and effort that chefs put in and go through to achieve a dish. All right, number five, New York City, Brooklyn.
This is another restaurant. You've been to two of the 10 on the list.
Yeah.
I've been
to this one.
And then Hearts. This was the way we divided up
Hearts,
the essays.
That's number five, Hearts in Brooklyn.
In Brooklyn, H-A-R-T apostrophe S. This was Julia's kind of love child.
This one, well, no, I think she has another love child. Yeah, there's a different love child named Philip. But this is kind of a Bon Appetit love child. As you guys talked about, every year there's kind of that one restaurant that everyone on staff ends up going to, whether it was Wild Air last year,
Estella the year before.
And it's just people just sort of pile on to these places. What did you like about Hearts, Julia?
I just loved the simplicity of it. I was blown away by how just dialed in the food was from the minute that they opened. And it's sort of a blessing and a curse to have a restaurant in New York City, because on the one hand, it means that we can go back and revisit it as many times as we want. And on the other hand, it means that we can do that. And so we can see, where a restaurant might falter or, have inconsistencies and whatever. And Hearts was so unbelievably consistent every time I went, which, I can't even count the number of times that I've been there. And it's just amazing. I thought, with the chef, Nick Perkins, who is an alum of Andrew Tarlow's restaurants, which are sort of known for this very rustic, beautiful style of cooking. It was amazing to me what he was able to do with just a really delicious, thick-cut piece of toast, really high-quality olive oil, the freshest seafood. Those things together make dishes like the clam toast, which has sort of become an iconic dish of the restaurant. And I would say that was, if I had to pick one thing there that was my favorite, I would probably say that, tied with the olive oil cake. And I just really, it's that restaurant where anytime I have someone who's coming in from out of town and they're like, where should we go. It's always hearts. And I think they just have a really good attitude as well. You know, there's a lot of restaurants in New York that sort of open with a lot of hype and they don't live up to that. And hearts is sort of the opposite. It just always feels very understated. And it's also a really great place to drink wine. They have wonderful natural wine.
I also think, I mean, hearts is representative of what we've seen in American dining over the last 5 years, that it's an unassuming place. And in particular, it's in Bed-Stuy, right outside a subway stop in a quirky little oblong-shaped room.
Yeah, it's a weird space.
It's not some big build-out. It's not super impressive from the outside, but, you know, just really beautifully prepared, thoughtful food. And the focus is on the food. And you don't have to spend $500,000 to open a restaurant anymore. You can have great cooking, and even a tiny little place in Bed-Stuy.
And it's also, I have to say that, you know, Brooklyn restaurants gained a reputation across the world as kind of being these quirky little, I think sometimes pretentious and with poor service and nobody smiled and a little too cool for school. Hearts is not that at all. I mean, it is a neighborhood restaurant trying to be a part of the community there. And I think next time you're in New York City, go out to Hearts and see kind of what we're lucky enough to live in New York City and to discover these kind of restaurants. They're pretty special. So number four on the list is another weird place. This is Polizzi Social Club in Philadelphia.
The fact that you haven't taken me here makes me angry at you.
Well, here's the thing about this place, and I just want to put this out here, and this is probably going to make some people pretty upset. This is a members-only Italian-American kind of throwback restaurant. It's in South Philly. All the vinyl siding. It's basically on a row of houses, and it looks like a house. There's just a little red neon sign that says Polizzi Social Club. So the story about this place is Joey Baldino, who has an amazing restaurant just across the bridge in New Jersey called Zeppoli. His uncle was a member of this private Italian social club that you see throughout the Northeast and especially in New York. And it was basically vacant for a while, and his uncle came to him and said, "Do you want this space?" And he was like, "Sure." This is kind of the food. So what he's done is taken those Italian-American classics that he grew up with, kind of tweaked them, but kept them, you know, recognizable to everybody. And it literally, like, when you open the door, it's like kind of Pompeii, like nothing has changed. The old cigarette machine is still there. The vinyl bar is there. It's kitschy, but without being too cute or feeling like some sort of Disney World version of it. Now, the first time I went was with Joe Badia, who owns Badia Pizzeria. They're only open from Thursday to Sunday, and he had already gotten a membership. Here's how you get a membership. You show up they open at 6 p.m. You show up as maybe at 5:30. You knock on the door, and there'll be this little, you know, sliding thing that you can just see somebody's eyes. It's a little weird, but it costs $20 to get a membership.
Do they size you up and like, yeah, no?
You know, I don't know. No, I don't think so. I was able to get a membership, which I'll come back to that in 2 seconds. But so recently they've kind of stopped giving memberships to people because it's getting a little bit crazy and they want to keep it normal. The best way to get in is to make friends with somebody who's already a member, and any member can take up to 3 non-members.
Oh, cool.
So there is a way to get in.
So it's basically like Rao's.
New York. Well, that's the thing. People are going to get upset, but it's, you know, you talk about some of the places that have been on our, you know, list in years past, like Bad Saint or State Bird Provisions or Rose's Luxury. You can wait 3 or 4 hours to get in here. This, you have a fighting chance to get into. And once you are in, it is worth it. It's not pretentious. There's nobody, you know, pouring Cristal or like, it's just solid, humble food that's really cool.
Best thing you ate there?
Man, he does this amazing bread plate that has these little triangle kind of pockets that have anchovy stuff in. He makes his own grissini, which is the long kind of bread stick. He makes a classic like sesame seeded loaf. And then it comes with this kind of cooked down red sauce that is kind of broken. So the oils kind of separate. Yeah. And you just dip that and you're drinking a martini, and it's just God, it's so awesome.
Nolton, don't fill up on the bread, though, man.
No, don't fill up on the bread.
All right, number three, going out to San Francisco, Julia.
Number three is Mr. Juice. This is a Chinese-American restaurant in the heart of San Francisco's Chinatown. It's run by Brandon Chu, who, as Andrew mentioned, is another one of those chefs who we're always sort of just following. He's been sort of on the verge of opening this place, Mr. Chu's, for a few years now, and it really did live up to all of that anticipation. It's a beautiful restaurant that's in what used to be a sort of Chinese banquet hall called Four Seas, and he really maintained a lot of the elements of that old space while creating food that feels very sort of like fresh, you know, Bay Area-ish in terms of sourcing really, really, really good ingredients and cooking them with sort of like a lighter touch. And everything about the space is just so personal to him. And it was so, it's another one of those things where like you wish that everyone could go there, could then talk to him for an hour, because you really see how every detail just has like a specific meaning to him, whether it's, you know, the design of the menu or the light fixtures that they refurbished from the old Four Seas space, or the process that he uses to age the duck. Everything is just really thoughtful and really just lovely. I can't wait to go back there. My sister lives in San Francisco, so that's one where I know I'll be back there soon.
Two questions. Where did Brenner work before opening the restaurant?
So he was a chef at Bar Agricole before Mr. Jew's, and then he spent a lot of time on the line at Quinn's in San Francisco, and then also Zini Cafe. So he sort of has like the essential San Francisco resume.
And then a couple of so he took this sort of classic San Francisco schooling and training, appreciation for the finest ingredients and locally sourced and organic and all that. And what are some of the dishes he's applying those to at Mr. Jew's to give us that sense of sort of classic Chinese-American cooking, but yet updated?
So like the Peking duck, for example, which is a very classic dish that many people associate with Chinese restaurants in America. He does his version of that where he sources these, you know, the best duck that he can find. I think they're from a farm called Liberty Farms. And then he uses the sort of traditional technique of how he air dries them. Another example would be like the Berkshire pork buns, which are another thing that, you know, you've probably seen a million times, but in his version, he doesn't use any like food dye or food coloring. And so the color comes all from, you know, I think it's from beets or other like red vegetables. He just trying to think of some better examples.
What about, and he does all those different dumplings, a whole variety of dumplings that are really unique in their, with their fillings and colorings and whatnot, correct?
Yeah. Yeah. He does these multicolored dumplings. Did that photo end up in the magazine? I'm so out of it.
Yes.
It did, and it's beautiful.
It's we call it Mr. Jew and the Technicolor dumplings. I think it's probably one of the most compelling photos in the magazine this month. And he uses everything from like sweet potatoes to beets to pea shoots to make this dough that goes around a dumpling, and it's just and then the ingredients are like lamb, and it's so familiar to you when you sit down and then you taste it, and it's like, wow, I don't remember my Chinese American food tasting this good, you know, growing up.
No, I love that about this country, is that we sort of evolve and we experiment and we come up with something new. All right, we got two left. Number two, Julia, we're going back to your hometown, Chicago. What do we got?
Yes. Elsky. I love this restaurant so much. The name Elsky is actually Danish for love, which makes sense because the chefs are husband and wife, David and Anna Posey. And as we were talking about earlier, this is really an example of that sort of culture of mentorship that exists in Chicago, because both David and Anna worked at Paul Kahn's restaurants. David was the chef of Blackbird for a while. Anna was the pastry chef of Publican. They opened their own place in the West Loop. It's a beautiful restaurant. It has sort of I want to say a Danish modern look to it. It's very minimalist and understated and has lots of personal touches. Like Anna is also an artist, and she drew the wallpaper that's in the bathroom. And it has this great outdoor area where they have a fire pit and they have benches around it. And the first time I was there in the winter, and they had animal pelts draped on the benches, and it had almost that like Fabakin type of vibe to the outdoors. And then the food that they cook is very much like modern contemporary American, which is sort of a generic description, but I think it's just very hard to describe. I mean, it's like perfectly executed. They have a tasting menu, or you can do a la carte, and they have just this very sophisticated approach to flavor but at the same time, the food is so delicious. And I think a lot of times you see food that looks like art, you know, looks so beautiful, and then you bite into it and you're like, okay, this tastes like cardboard. Often there's like a mismatch between those two things. And I think one thing that makes this restaurant so special is like, the food is so elevated and sophisticated, but it tastes almost like a little bit nostalgic, and just like fires on all those like pleasure centers of eating that I think fine dining often misses.
Most favorite dish?
My favorite are all of Anna's desserts. I love all the savory food, but Andrew actually makes fun of me because I am so obsessed with the desserts there. I just think that she's a genius.
All right, so if you're going to order one dessert, if you're a listener, what are you ordering?
I think that the one dessert that is sort of a mainstay on the menu, because the desserts are very much seasonal, just like the rest of the menu, is the black and white halva tart, which we also have the recipe for on bonappetit.com. And that is a speculoos cookie tart shell filled with black and white sesame mousse and crumbled halva. It is incredible.
All right, Andrew Knowlton, the number one restaurant in America, which I would not describe as minimalist or tasting menu-y or elevated. What do we got?
Drum roll. It's Turkey and the Wolf in New Orleans, Louisiana. So, interesting story about this. When Julia and I had the top 10, we knew we loved these 10 restaurants that you've just heard about. And then we did this exercise where we said, okay, rank them. What you think.
What each of you would rank.
Each of us would rank them. And this is no joke, Julia can confirm this, that we had the top 5 restaurants in the exact same order, both of us.
So no negotiating.
So I think we both had a sigh of relief, because Turkey and the Wolf is this weird sandwich shop in the Irish Channel neighborhood of New Orleans, kind of sleepy for New Orleans. And it's weird, right, Julia? It's a weird kind of funky, the chef Mason Hereford is crazy. The only thing he's better at than making sandwiches is inline skating. If that says anything, don't hold that against him. It's counter service. You walk in and they're blasting whatever hip hop or whatever like bad 80s music. They've got crazy tattoos. There's pictures of all the salt and pepper shakers are, little cartoon figurines that his mother had collected for him on eBay. And you order, and then you sit down and your sandwich comes, and it's just like time stops for a minute. It's like the most amazing food experience I think both Julia and I had, and it just happened to be a sandwich. For me, It was something called a collard green melt. So it was loosely based on a patty melt. It was braised greens that better than any Southern restaurant I've had. There was a kind of a spicy Russian meets pimento cheese dressing. This kind of beautiful coleslaw made with Duke's mayonnaise, which they go through more Duke's mayonnaise than one would ever think. And then it's a triple decker sandwich on rye, and just the way it comes together and you eat it, it stays together. It's better than any patty melt I've had. It's better than any pastrami on rye I've ever had. And it just happens to be a vegetarian sandwich at the same time. I could talk about the bologna sandwich.
Let's talk about the bologna sandwich.
So the bologna sandwich, it comes on basically Texas toast that a friend of Mason makes for him. Really thick cut. The bologna is made.
And they griddle that toast right. In butter so it gets nice and golden brown on the outside.
And something he does that him and his sous chef, Colleen, who deserves a shout out because she really, she keeps Mason in line. They let the bread rest. So when the bread comes off the griddle, they, almost like you would a steak, they let it rest. Mm. So the oils kind of go back in. Temperature gets nice when you put the mayonnaise on it. And he says it makes it crisper. If you just take it out real quick, it'll steam. So they have bologna that a friend of theirs makes. They use American cheese, a specific kind called Golden Harvest. They tasted over 20 American cheeses.
Wow, that sounds like a scary taste test.
Golden Harvest. And then it gets like shredis, which is a signature of Turkey and the Wolf, which is basically shredded lettuce. They call it shredis. A shit ton of Duke's mayo, more than you think necessary. And then it gets topped with vinegar-soaked potato chips.
Homemade potato chips?
Homemade potato chips. Mm. And then you just kind of, when it comes to your plate, it looks like one of those sandwiches you were talking about that you could not eat, that you need a knife and fork. But then you smash it down, and it kind of, that white bread is almost like a Martin's potato roll where it kind of forms around it and creates this pocket. And you bite into it, and it's just like all those, you know, bologna sandwiches with yellow mustard on white bread that my mom made, and all the variations that you can have where you put American cheese, and that cheese would get stuck on the roof of your mouth behind your teeth.
Yep.
That is what that sandwich does, and it takes every nostalgic thing that you've ever thought about a food you grew up with, and it just runs with it and surpasses it. And for me, my food kind of memories and taste don't happen at the restaurant. It's like 2 weeks later. I could not get Turkey and the Wolf and its sandwiches out of my mind 6 months later. And I think Julia feels the same way.
When we were putting together the list, I think both of us were thinking, what are the places that we had the best time at? And there was just no question that Turkey and the Wolf was number one on that list. It was just, it's just such a fun, enjoyable, pleasurable restaurant to go to. And I think that you couldn't find a less self-serious restaurant in the country. And it's just, I think that that's what people are looking for. I mean, that's certainly what I'm looking for when I go out, is a place where I can like truly and just enjoy the food and just enjoy being there.
And I think one thing I want to point out that I think, I don't want to call it the Turkey and Wolf effect because there's other restaurants that have done it, but you know, Mason did the classical route. He worked at Coquette for 6 years, which is a kind of a fancier restaurant in New Orleans. He used tweezers. He did beat eight ways. And I think what you're seeing a lot of times now is chefs are kind of, they want a different lifestyle. They don't want to kill themselves in kitchens, and they want to have a life, and they want to eat the food they want to eat. And I think that's what Turkey and the Wolf, I think you're going to see a lot more of that if chefs do it.
Yeah, it's fun. It's delicious. Turkey Wolf is also daytime only, correct, if you want to go?
They close at 9:30 or 10, okay, so they have a full bar, and it gets rowdy. I have a feeling that that place is going to morph. Their sandwiches will always be the backbone of that place, but I think with the success that they've had, that they have more ambition than they lead on. And I think you're going to see them morph probably into a full-blown restaurant at some point.
All right, good to know. Julia Kramer, thank you for calling in. Give Philip a kiss for us. Knowlton,
I will.
Thank you as always. And until next year, you can check out the Hot 10 America's Best New Restaurants on bonappetit.com, or you can pick up the September issue of Bon Appetit magazine on newsstands. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.